Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Anna Stever, a show about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Today, we're starting with the future of price tags, and that future is increasingly looking digital. Kroger and Walmart are moving towards eliminating those paper tags you see on the shelves, replacing them with digital screens that employees can update with the click of a button. But that click and switch ease worries some lawmakers and consumer advocates. They worry about price gouging, about whether retailers can now simply change a price at any time for any reason. Here to walk us through the debate over digital tags is Santiago Galino, Associate Professor of Operations, Information, and Decisions at the Wharton Business School. Welcome to All Sides, Professor.
Hi, good morning. Thank you very much for having me.
Good morning. So, like I said, retailers like Walmart and Kroger are beginning to replace those paper tags that we see when we go to the store with digital tags. Several Walmarts in California already have this technology, and they plan to implement it in 2,300 stores in the coming years. It feels on its face just like a natural evolution as we continue to become a paperless society.
Yes. This is a technology that it's not new, and for those of your listeners that had the opportunity to travel to Europe, they probably have already seen this. And even in the U.S., in other type of retailers like Best Buy has been using this now for some time. What I think is new here is the disruption of this technology in grocery retails. And I think it's a like you point out, a natural transition, and trying to bring more technology to the stores, which I think in principle is a good thing.
Yeah, and so how does the technology behind these tags work? I assume it's like any other screen; it just kind of pops up. I haven't seen one in my grocery stores yet, so.
Yes. So these are very similar to the paper labels that you have in terms of size. The only downside, and sometimes something that has kind of slowed down the adoption for retailers in the grocery category, is that they tend to be monochromatic, so they don't have the flashy colors that the retailers can use to signal a good discount or a promotion or something like that. But as you point out, these are kind of connected to a centralized location that will facilitate the price updates as needed, and with a simple click on a centralized place, you can update multiple prices not only in one store but most likely in multiple stores.
So consumer advocates, including U.S. Senator Elizabeth Warren, has raised concerns about price gouging. Their concern is that you could change the price multiple times a day for any real reason or whim. Has that happened in Europe and other places where these have gone in, or like, is that concern valid?
So, I mean, it's valid in the sense that it's possible to happen. However, if you talk to retailers like I've done over the last few years, I think one of the main drivers for this type of adoption is the effort that retailers are doing to reduce cost, become more efficient, become more lean in their operations, and at the end of the day, I think benefit their own customers. For retailers, the two main expenses they incur is like the buy the inventory or pay for that, and the expense on staffing. And as you can imagine, changing or updating the price tags when this is something that needs to do manually walking around the store is time consuming. And that time needs to be paid. And so I think that the main driver for adoption is the opportunity to reduce cost on the retailer side. And one of the reasons I think that Europe has been ahead of the curve in adopting this technology is that in general, the dollars per hour that grocery stores employees get paid in Europe is usually higher than in the US. And that puts the the business justification to adopt the technology easier to be made in Europe. But these days, between the cost of the technology going down, some of the companies that are trying to be more competitive in the labor market that are increasing their hourly wages, now it makes it more more reasonable to start to adopt that technology here. So that, I think, is the main driver. However, as you said, once you have the technology, you can use it for the right reasons or for reasons that probably, I would argue, not very smart.
Yeah, it made me think of Wendy's, the fast food company. A couple months ago tried to roll out dynamic or surge pricing for its menus, and there was massive backlash to the idea.
Yes, yes. And that, I think, is like in any business, you could be concerned about how the company will behave, but customers, all of us, tend to react to those things. And if you ask me, I think that if grocery retailers are trying to incorporate this technology to do price discrimination or being too smart about how they pricing, customers will notice, and that can definitely backfire. So I think that is not the underlying reason. I think they're trying to reduce cost. Another thing that in recent years has also become a challenge for them is to keep consistent prices between online and in-store options. As you can imagine, like changing prices online because of its digital nature has always been easy. But then if you need to go around updating prices in the store, that creates a friction. But now with this technology, you can imagine that can be done again, if you use it right, will benefit the retailers and the customers too.
Yeah, we do accept dynamic pricing in certain places, like Uber charges more during peak time, theme parks, movies. But yeah, with food, I don't think we're really going to be tolerant of that kind of change. I do wonder if it's more in line with the trend of having fewer employees in store. You know, I have watched my grocery store go from like 3 or 4 self-checkouts to like almost exclusively self-checkout. And I feel like digital pricing would require even fewer employees because you don't have to physically put the little papers into all the slots.
Yes. Yes. And I think that is also something that you can imagine that some retailers will decide to repurpose some of the staff in the store. Like you described, it's been also my experience that sometimes you are in the grocery stores and you want to find someone to ask a question. It's almost like an impossible mission, right?
Yes.
There's no one on the floor to help you. And that, I think, as a consumer experience, might not be the best experience. And so maybe this is an opportunity to maintain the staffing level, but instead of having people around the store changing labels, you have the same people, but now with a little bit more of a service component to the customers that are already in the store. I don't think that every retailer is going to play that game. Some retailers definitely want to cut the cost, and maybe this will drive less employees in the floor, but some others will allow this technology will allow them to refocus on the customer service experience and invest those hours of labor in something that is more productive than just updating the shelf labels.
Yeah, I mean, I know there's an upfront cost with these to get them installed, to get them up and running, to maintain them. But I was thinking, and I never had considered it up until we were doing this segment, how much paper a grocery store probably goes through just for those little price tags.
Yes, and I think that this I think is another driver that these days both companies and customers are more sensitive about, like how much waste is in our daily lives, and I definitely think this can help in that front. It's not only the shelf labels, but also all the promotional material that if you're constantly updating prices, then it becomes less relevant because you're going to update the price of the promotion you send. So maybe that will also reduce that waste. Again, this all, I think, points into the similar direction. Like any company that is well run will try to reduce waste in any form. It could be paper waste, it could be labor waste, and I think that bringing technology into the picture is a good thing. Like I mentioned before, it's always the question of how we use it. But the technology itself, I think, is something exciting and can be used for great things.
I don't know. I wonder about, I don't know if anybody would, but I kind of wonder about the security of these because they are digital. Like if some disgruntled employee on the way out could turn like a whole bunch of stuff to 99 cents.
Well, that would be nice for us, the customers, if that can be done. I suspect that there are like these guarders in place
I would hope so.
to avoid those things. But you know, it's always the hope that you will be able to get a deal out of a glitch in the system.
I also wonder with like power outages and like maintenance, I mean, the paper tags are still readable when the power is not functioning. And, you know, sometimes there are power outages and the grocery stores have generators for certain things, but not others. Like, there are risks there.
Definitely, and this is again this a usual trade-off with technology. I think that if you go to a restaurant these days, you could see how the waitress tend to take the order with some version of an electronic iPad or something that makes everything efficient, goes to the kitchen, and like last weekend we were with my family in a kind of traditional restaurant where the server was writing down a large order and that was actually my comment. So, well, this is super resilient. Even if the power goes down, we can still do this. I think that that's a tension. I think that I'm sure that the retailers and the vendors are kind of thinking of ways to make this technology reliable and resilient to this type of disruption. Both, like you mentioned before, in terms of like ill-intended disruptors in the technology front, but also some more pedestrian thing like power outages or the technology failing altogether. I mean, if your laptop is like mine, we sometimes cannot start the laptop in the morning, and you can imagine customers in the store and none of the prices being displayed because of a glitch. That is things you want to avoid. Again, I will be less concerned about this. For this particular technology, because it's been around for many years now, it's been proven in Europe, and I'm sure they went through those learning things and learning stages there. Hopefully, when it gets to the US, this is a well-proven technology.
Yeah, we do see it in certain places. Like, if you've ever gone to Kohl's, the clothing retailer, they have digital screens that'll tell you the percentage off, right? So you don't have to calculate in your head what 20, 30, 50% off is. So they are popping up in, I think it feels in some ways just inevitable.
I think so, and I think so, and I think that this technology can actually translate into price reductions because if the store become more efficient, and there is competition in the market, that can actually end up helping everyone.
That was Santiago Golino, a professor of operations, information, and decisions at the Wharton School of Business. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh no, thank you very much for having me.
Coming up, ethanol production in Ohio and a bipartisan bill to offset new federal rules. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
No matter what happens in Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Anna Staver, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. Ohio is one of the country's largest ethanol producers, and yet few gas stations here in the Buckeye State offer something called E15, a gasoline blend that's 15% corn, or ethanol. Tad Nicholson is the executive director of Ohio Corn and Wheat, and he wants to change that. He joins us now to talk about E15 and the future of ethanol. Tad, welcome to All Sides.
Thanks for having me, Anna.
So when I think of ethanol and, you know, I think of Iowa. I think of the Iowa pledge and presidential politics. But how did Ohio become such a player in the business?
Well, I think it's a matter of we make ethanol where the corn is grown. And so Ohio ranks seventh in corn production in the United States. And we also rank seventh in ethanol production in the United States. So it does. Iowa is certainly number one. I will give that to them. But Ohio is a major agriculture state, and that makes us really prime to make ethanol. In fact, we have seven ethanol plants in the state. A lot of people don't even know that.
Yeah, I didn't know that 40% of the corn grown here goes to become ethanol.
Yeah, it's a major market, something very important to agriculture, which I represent the agriculture community and represent corn and wheat farmers, and this is a very valuable market to maintain and grow.
So let's talk about E15. It is a gasoline sold as unleaded 88, but Ohioans are pretty unlikely to see that at the pump.
Well, you know, you're right. I would like to change that. And I think, and honestly, consumers would like to see that change because unleaded 88, have you ever seen, there's about 215 stations in the state right now that have it. So
how many stations do we have total?
I don't know, thousands. I mean, we're at the beginning here. And so this is why we're on talking about this tax credit that would help incentivize other fuel retailers to carry it. Because
yeah.
If you look at that, it's a higher octane, 88 octane, as opposed to 87, which is what normally we all get. But it's less expensive. And so,
yeah,
and that's kind of an enticing thing to have higher octane. That's better for your car, lower price. Pretty cool. It's something that we really would like to see spread throughout the state.
Yeah. So I understand it was approved by the federal government in 2011. And cars, trucks, SUVs manufactured later than 2001 can use it.
Yeah. And that represents like 96 or 97% of all the cars. So your car and mine, I'm going to guess, made since 2001. We certainly can use that. The first question you get is this safe for my car? Because it's different. I think what we've learned is a lot of consumers don't really want to study fuel. They don't really even care about fuel. They just want to go to a station, get some liquid in their car that makes it go forward. And that's fine. We don't want them to have to study either. The question to answer is it safe for my car? And the answer is absolutely yes.
So one of the things I read in preparing for this is that E15 is about 22 cents per gallon cheaper.
Yeah. In fact, I just filled up and there are several retailers having this, but the largest one right here in central Ohio has been Sheetz. And for whatever reason, they decided to give everybody a holiday gift and it's 40 cents less than 87 right now.
So, oh, my goodness.
So check one out on your way home.
I just filled up my tank this morning.
Oh,
do not tell me this.
Anna, yeah.
I should have gone to a Sheetz. But I was doing the math on it. So my tank holds about 15 gallons, which is like a pretty average size tank. And I go through about a tank a week, which means this would save me $170 a year. And I was like, oh, wow.
These are real savings. And you know, I think Americans today would like to keep that in their pocket as opposed to spending it on fuel. And so it's a win-win for everybody. Obviously, I work for farmers, so we like corn demand. And the more ethanol we can use, it's going to be good for the agriculture community. But
you've got a perspective, but it is bipartisan, which is not always an easy feat over at the State House.
How many things are bipartisan today? I mean, really, it's an amazing thing to have. This topic is really kind of good for everybody. And so it has really enjoyed a lot of bipartisanship.
So why has E15 not taken off?
Well, so it's new. Retailers they need to do some infrastructure changes. So as a pump that has to be UL certified, whatnot, and many of them are, but there's some underground things that you know are
so blend, there's upgrades.
You know, there's some upgrades there, which is why this tax incentive would help offset some of those costs. And maybe if you're a fuel retailer, this will help you make a business decision to offer this to your customers, and they get to benefit from lower price fuel.
Let's talk about it. So it's House Bill 324. It's moving through the legislature right now. It has just a couple of weeks to get done before the end of the year, but it's 5 cents per gallon for 4 years or until $10 million runs out, correct?
Well, yep, you
okay.
Got it. There's all sorts of safeties in this. So if you're in the state legislature and you're leery of some new tax credit coming on, this one's about as easy as it gets. It's a non-refundable, so you have to have a tax liability for a retailer to get it. It is capped out. It's not an endless pot of money. It's $10 million. That's it. And it's 4 years. And so you got to move now if you want to take advantage of this.
So there has been a lot I learned of back and forth at the federal level about E15 and whether to permit sales of it year round, specifically in the summer. So I wanted to ask, the National Marine Manufacturers Association says it can destroy marine engines and it should not be used in boats. And that's why they don't want it sold in the summer.
Well, a couple of different topics there. Number one, I have a boat and it runs E15 all the time. It certainly is absolutely safe for modern day engines that. But the E15 year round thing, it's an obscure, this is a separate thing from this tax bill.
Yeah.
But federally, we're trying to get this fixed. It's an obscure old regulation. The way the Clean Air Act was written, it allowed summer sales of E10, but not E15. It doesn't specifically say E15. So they right now have you can't sell it all year. Definitely trying to get that fixed federally, and there's a great large coalition of people that want to get that fixed. But it is it's a matter of time. We'll get it done.
Yeah, in October there was a bipartisan group in the House, the U.S. House, that has introduced what's called the Consumer and Fuel Retailer Choice Act to legalize its sale year-round. And here in Ohio, Mike Carey, Marcy Kaptur, Greg Landsman, and Max Miller are all co-sponsors.
That's a bipartisan group of people you just mentioned, and so it is. It's a bipartisan issue. We have agreement, and we've done joint lobbying on this, even with the petroleum industry. So there's nobody opposed to this. It's a matter of getting things through Congress, which, as you probably know, is a kind of a slow process.
Yeah, one of the other concerns that came up when I was researching it is that concerns that the federal EPA hasn't done enough messaging to protect consumers whose cars cannot handle ethanol blends.
Well, you know, it's very few people out there that don't. I think it's these high performance engines and that, where if the manufacturer says you need to use 90 plus octane, well, that's fine. They can certainly, you know, go in and do that. But we do have 96% of the cars on the road right now.
Yeah.
Absolutely can use it. And they're kind of getting penalized from this because they're not being able to enjoy this savings. And I think if we get that federal fix, we have a tax credit here in Ohio, more retailers will start to put this in because it makes complete sense.
Yeah. It also helps if you have a lower price listed on your board as people are driving by.
Yeah, exactly. What a way to pull them in so they can come in and buy soda pop and the other things that.
I think sometimes you see that. You see the ethanol label on them because it is on the pumps physically. Like, you do see that. And I think sometimes consumers just get a little skittish.
You know, one of the things that the good old EPA, you know, they're trying to do their best, I guess, but they made this. There's a yellow label above unleaded 88, and it says on there that it's approved for vehicles 2001 and newer, light-duty vehicles, and then next bullet point is flex fuel vehicles. And some people read that as you have to meet both of those.
Oh.
What it is, it's an either-or. So it can always run in flex fuel vehicles, but it also can run in any vehicle 2001 and newer. So it's very confusing to some people, but that's why we're on this show telling people that this is absolutely safe. You could go ahead and enjoy the lower cost fuel.
Yeah. And I think if you have a vintage car, you probably know enough about it to know not to put that kind of gasoline in it. Or at least I hope you do.
Yeah, that's true. I think most people, if you're a gearhead out there, they certainly know enough about the fuel going into their vehicles to know what can and can't go in. But
yeah. So we do have just a couple of weeks left in this legislative term. How optimistic are you that this legislation moves?
Well, you know, the lame duck process is a wild ride, and so there's a lot of things that have to move, and so we want this to be inserted into one of those, and so we're asking
you want to put it in a Christmas tree bill?
Yes, exactly. Well, I mean, it's already passed out of the House unanimously. It went over to the Senate,
and not many things pass unanimously.
Exactly, not very many things do. Went over to the Senate, and it got stuck in a committee, and so now it's time to unstuck it and get it into a bill that can actually move. And there's a lot of support from the Speaker's office on down.
Oh, great. Yeah. So for those who don't know, a Christmas tree bill is literally kind of what it sounds like. You take a bunch of things that are kind of closely related to each other and you hang them like ornaments on a tree and you build a piece of legislation that passes. And this very much tends to happen in the final weeks because it is universal to procrastinate.
It is. And it sounds negative to a lot of people that aren't in politics, but sometimes it's necessary because there's just a lot of things to get done. There's very few things to vote on. So you got to put a lot of things packaged together. This is one of those bills that we need to have packaged.
Yeah. And it sounds like a lot of the farmers that you work with are very like pushing for it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, anything we could do to increase corn demand, you know, agriculture is Ohio's number one industry. We have thousands and thousands of family farms delivering corn to ethanol plants. And anytime we can increase demand for that product, farmers benefit. And so this is a very beneficial thing to Ohio's agriculture community.
How much do you know about the science of it, the way ethanol gets made? I don't know if it's a fair question to ask you, because like I try to imagine it in my head, right? Like oil comes out of the ground, they refine it, they make gas. But then I'm like, what on earth are they doing with the corn?
You need to come to an ethanol plant with me sometime, Anna. And
I'll show you. Like, I'm dead serious. But I would totally love to.
I think you may be underwhelmed, though, because honestly, look, this is an old product. I mean, Henry Ford built the first Model T to run on corn alcohol.
What?
And so, yep. And so it was, it's basically moonshine. That's all it is.
We've
made it for years.
But don't drink it.
Well, no, you wouldn't drink this. It wouldn't be the tasty kind. But this is an old technology of fermenting corn into alcohol. It's been done for.
So it's a grain alcohol.
It's a grain alcohol. It's absolutely what it is. And
oh.
It's very simple. But it's cleaner burning. The thing is, the environment gets to benefit because it is less greenhouse. Anytime we can blend ethanol into gasoline, lowers the greenhouse gas emissions from that. So 15% is better than 10%. So we want to keep ratcheting that up.
Yeah. Do you think we'll ever get to a place where it's all ethanol?
I don't think so. I mean, honestly, though, this is about extending, you know, our fossil fuels. Anytime we can, you know, be able to, I mean, Ohio is a big oil state too. And so we can use both
can
of those
both.
By blending them together, and we get to extend that supply longer.
Are they working on any higher blends? Like, is there an E20 in the works?
Oh, there always is, but it has to be approved by the EPA. They have
right.
to approve a fuel blend, and E20 wouldn't be approved yet, but E15 is. And so we're working on
right.
E15, unleaded 88 right now.
Yeah, that's really fascinating, too, the way in which it goes through the approval process and it gets to sale. Then I'm assuming car manufacturers have to agree to make some sort of change to how their engines work so they can accommodate this?
Yeah, that has to be in their warranty, which it is today. So it's in the warranty books. It's all approved for unleaded 88 up to E15. Oftentimes you'll see that inside the gas tank door. You'll see
sticker that I never look at.
Yes, exactly. That a lot of people don't look at. And so it's approved for up to E15.
Good, because that's always the fear, right? Like, I look at it sometimes warily and I'm like, is that going to break my engine?
Well, it's a common question. And again, I just don't think most people don't want to study it. They just want to go get the fuel, get moving on with your day. And so it's getting the word out that you are allowed to save money. That's what the message is today. You are permitted to buy the lower priced fuel. It's 88 octane. Sometimes it'll have a blue handle. Not every retailer has to, but a lot of times it'll have a blue handle.
Oh.
And you can absolutely go in and reach for that. And it is safe for your car.
Not the green handle, that's diesel.
That's right. Don't get the, don't, we'll have problems then.
Yeah, so you said a lot of boats can take it. What about motorcycles or ATVs, recreational vehicles?
EPA hasn't approved E15 for small engines or ATVs in motorcycles. So we're talking about light duty vehicles, cars, trucks, SUVs that are all light duty. Those are the ones that are the big market for E15.
What about your lawnmower?
It is not approved for lawnmowers
okay.
either. So there's always going to be an E10 offered at the stations.
But you can use E10 in your lawnmower?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Yep, you bet.
I'm learning all kinds of things about what I can't. I'm sure my husband knows all this, but I'm like, oh, okay, so.
It's really not as scary as a lot of people make it. It's 5% more ethanol than what we are all using right now. I mean, 10% ethanol is in this entire country's fuel supply right now. And it's just not labeled at the pump anymore because it doesn't matter. It's just sort of baked into the system.
Are you optimistic about the federal legislation as well? I mean,
I am. I mean, it really is. There is no opponents to this federal fix. There's nobody that says we should not allow E15 sold year round in the entire country. And so it's just a list of states
where it's prohibited.
Pardon me?
Yeah, it was like a list of a dozen states when I was looking it up.
There's only one state left, and that's the great country of California that does not allow E15 for whatever reasons, because they're very environmentally conscious, and E15 cleans the air. It's a cleaner fuel than the E10 that they're using now. So,
but they don't allow it?
California doesn't allow that. It's the only state.
Why?
You'd have to ask the Californians on that one. I have no answer for you on that. It doesn't make any sense. They don't want to, you know, it's a cleaner for the environment. California likes that. Lower cost. California should like that. It's a It's a mystery to us.
Mm.
They'll get there.
So final question for you. If House Bill 324, that's correct, right? House Bill 3, if it does not make it through this process, are you going to try to come back next year, get it through the next General Assembly?
Yeah, that's the game. I mean, it's sometimes getting a piece of legislation passed is a long slug. And so we're, you know, very hopeful that it happens in lame duck. But if not, there certainly will be an effort by all of our champions down here that they will start the process again come beginning of 2025.
Yeah, for those who don't know, like I always think it takes like, sometimes it takes like 2, 3, 4, 5 runs at something to actually get it passed.
It does, but they're hearing us. There's actually a call to action right now, and it's on our website, ohiocornandwheat.org. The first thing you'll pop up is consumers can click on that, and they could tell the General Assembly, get this thing passed. We want it done in lame duck. The quicker we get it done, the quicker Ohioans get to save money on fuel.
And for those who wonder, like that actually, like the legislature's, They read it. Like sometimes they get form letters where they can tell that, but if people are even taking time to fill out the form, like you hear them talk about it, they're like, I am getting hundreds of letters from my constituents about issue X.
Exactly. They do actually listen. The process does work. It's clunky sometimes, but the process absolutely works and people should make their voice heard.
That was Tad Nicholson, Executive Director of Ohio Corn and Wheat. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Coming up, it's the start of our annual tech gift guide, and we're starting with what's hot for kids under 12. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
No matter what happens in Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Saver. Tis the season to shop. At least that's what retailers across the country are hoping for. I don't know about you, but my inbox has exploded with every kind of Black Friday deal imaginable. And with so many options, we were wondering, what are the best bets? And how do you know you're actually getting the best price? Well, Russell Holly, Managing Editor for Commerce in CNET, is back with his annual gift-giving guide. Welcome back to All Sides, Russell.
Thank you.
We're kicking it off with children ages 12 or under, which I selfishly love since I have two of those at home. And the first item that you recommend is an upgrade to the Star Wars lightsaber. And you say that this is your new favorite gift for Star Wars fans, but don't call it a lightsaber. It's a power saber.
It's very specific language because Star Wars, you know, obviously owns the word lightsaber. And so anyone who makes something that is not affiliated with them, there ends up being some legal collisions. However, you know, I certainly remember when I was, 10 and was very excited about Star Wars. And I know every other 10-year-old that I've ever seen be excited about Star Wars. They've all wanted a lightsaber that does exactly one thing. And that is you push the button and the blade actually pops up on its own. No like flicking it out, no like connecting an LED stick to it to light up when you push the button, to have it actually extend just like it does in the movies. And the closest thing you're going to get to that for under $50 is this setup that has recently been released by the folks at Power Savers.
Yeah, you have a video of you in costume doing it, which I laughed. I was like, this is amazing.
I was very excited that it actually works as well as it does. It makes, you know, very funny sounds when you swish it around in the air. If you hit it up against something, it sounds like a lightsaber is hitting something. You can safely poke someone with it without hurting someone because it will collapse back into itself when that happens, because the first thing a kid is going to do with a lightsaber is swing it at someone else who, you know, has a stick or a cardboard tube or another lightsaber. But yeah, these are incredibly cool. They currently come in three different colors. The blades that extend, there's the standard green, a very common red, and then yellow for our most recent Jedi Master Rey.
Ah, and it's pretty quick. Like the lightsaber goes up in just a couple of seconds. Like I was watching the video and I was like, oh, wow, that's really fast.
Yeah, it's fast, but it is steady in such a way that you're not going to really catch someone by surprise, and there's a lot less chance that someone could, be hurt. And if you extend it and you're like, trying to push it into someone, it will not continue to, push to hurt them.
Yeah. And then the price tag is, a ride around the $50 mark is good because some of those lightsabers, like you can get like replicas that are many, many hundreds of dollars.
Yeah, even if you just get the replicas that are sold by Disney, like in the parks or on the website, you're looking at, starting at around $150, and they kind of go
Oh
up
my
from there.
goodness.
Yeah, so they can kind of get up there as far as price goes, and there's always the, you walk into Walmart and there's a pile of lightsabers sitting on a shelf that are 10 bucks that you flick out and do, the fall apart in a couple of weeks, but they're a lot of fun while you've got them. This is a really great in between. I've been using this one for a little while with every, kind of niece and nephew that I have access to, and so far I have failed to break it. So I would say that it's usually, if I am not going to ruin something, then there's a pretty safe bet that that it'll withstand most other people. So yeah, I would say for the, they're around $50 depending on where you get them. I think they're on sale right now at Walmart for 45. And you're going to find them a really good option for young ones in your life who are big fans of Star Wars.
How much does it weigh? Like, how, what is the age range on this to wield this particular power saber?
This is right around a pound, and it is certainly going to be bigger than you would see your average lightsaber be because it's got some of these, kind of extra bits on the inside. But the youngest that I have handed this to has been four, and they've had no problem using it.
That's good to know, especially if you have multiple siblings. You can't arm one sibling without arming the other.
That's exactly right.
I think it's like a really fun alternative. And yeah, I love that it's not 150 bucks. So let's talk about the wall crawler gecko.
That's right. So every year when we do these, I try to make sure that at least one of them is as kind of sciency and engineering as possible. And the folks at Hexbots, for a really long time, have had these great, like, kind of build it yourself kits that teach kids something new each time. Sometimes it's little kind of skitter robots that'll crawl across the floor. But the one that they've really focused on this year is this wall crawling gecko, and it is pretty much exactly what it looks like. There is a remote control that allows you to go up, down, left, right, and there is a kind of suction function that makes it so that this very light toy will crawl up walls.
Wow, does it dam how does it do that without damaging the wall?
It's a little tiny bit of suction and some rubber treading that will go up walls. I have yet to ruin any of the walls in my house. The same cannot be said for those like sticky geckos that you like, kind of
Oh,
throw and stick
yeah.
to walls. There are several stains on my walls and ceiling as a result of being an adult that owns those. But yeah, I haven't noticed any harm from this. The battery life on it is the only real thing that I would want to, kind of warn, because of, the way that this works. You're getting about a half an hour of gameplay out of it before it would need to be recharged.
Yeah, I have to say those sticky geckos and slime in particular are the bane of my parenting existence.
Yes, and slime has only gotten more popular and filled with more things as we have grown into parenthood. So it has been a real challenge.
Yeah, if anybody ever needs tips on how to get it out of carpet, I have like I've nailed it. I got it down to a science. So this little gecko, what does it run you?
You can find these on Amazon starting at around $18.
Oh, that's not bad at all.
Yeah, depending on where you go to find them, they may, kind of vary in pricing there by about $2 or $3. But yeah, usually that's a solid like under $20 option.
Yeah, how is it like life size? About the same size as like a live gecko?
It's a little bigger. It'll fit in the palm of an adult hand,
Okay.
but it is a, kind of a larger plastic toy.
What happens when it runs out of power? Like, what if you're like, what if you have it crawling all the way up a wall and it's like running out of juice? Is it gonna like fall off?
It's got some adhesion to the, not adhesion, but some non-friction matting to help with that. But you're not going to be able to leave it up there for any extended period of time. It will fall pretty quickly after it loses power.
Yeah. Hexbots has nano bugs. remote-controlled dragons that breathes real fire? That doesn't feel child safe.
it is a light burst. It is not like an extended flame. There's not like a lighter inside of it. But yeah, you definitely want to, you know, be supervising when using that one.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, I think that one says age is 8 and up. So yeah, just keep that in mind.
Who doesn't want to give an 8-year-old fire? That's
actually, I have we call my daughter a fire drake because she hoards gemstones. So it'd be like the perfect thing for her. So then you have the Bitsy digital pet, and it's a digital pet you can touch.
Yes. So this is probably the coolest kids toy that I have seen this year. Bitsies are these, kind of palm sized plastic cases. They look almost like slightly larger iPod cases.
Okay.
And when you lift up the lid, there is this shutter that flickers back and forth, and there's an LED strip that creates a holographic image of any one of 20 different pets that you can, in very much old school Tamagotchi style, you feed and take care of and play games with and pet by touching down on this thing. And as you play, you will continue to unlock more characters. There is the original version of Bitsy, which has, uniquely created pets, by the company, but the company is also partnered with Disney. And as a part of that partnership, there is a version of Bitsy you can get that is 30 different very popular Disney characters, including Stitch and Olaf and a bunch of these other characters that you can unlock as you continue to play.
So less Furby, more Tamagotchi, but it like creates like a 3D image up in front of your face.
It is this two-dimensional hologram that will, put up for you. It is surprisingly difficult to describe for as much fun and relatively simple once you're holding it. But the display technology that makes this work really is the thing that kind of makes it stand out. It is kind of hovering in front of you when you're holding this thing in your hand.
Yeah, it reminds me of that scene from, I think it's like Jurassic Park 5, where they use the hologram. And like I can't remember the name of the dinosaur flashes up to distract the raptor, but it's not that advanced.
It is not quite that advanced. And it is very cartoony, the way that everything is animated in an almost 8-bit fashion. It really, if you were a Tamagotchi kid, especially in like late 90s, early 2000s, you may struggle to not give this to a child and instead just play with it yourself.
Can I tell you, I was so butthurt about the fact that you would take care of it, grow it, be so diligent, and then it would like go home anyway.
Yeah, I don't think we talk enough about how that game didn't actually have an ending.
Ugh. It was frustrating. So how do you determine which kind of toys make your gift guide? What kind of testing and reviewing do you do over at CNET to make sure that you're finding these?
A lot of it, we are a team of folks. A lot of us have kids. So it ends up being, kind of an active conversation about, one, safety features and pricing that we think is important as, kind of adults who have grown up with some of these similar toys. But ultimately, you've got to put toys in kids' hands and see how they react to them. If, there are a lot of things that I have found that I thought were extremely cool that young me would have absolutely loved that my niece will play with for 10 minutes and go, yeah, okay, that was fine, and walk away. And, I'm not going to recommend something like that if I don't see it holding the attention of one of the folks that I, kind of introduce it to.
Yeah, I think it depends on the kid. My daughter got an Ozobot last year and she loves it. But I don't know that that's for like every kid.
A lot of it definitely has to do with knowing your kid. Like there are so many really cool, like blind bag style things where you can like make your own potions and... I saw this blind box thing yesterday where you could create... like potted plants, like little fake resin potted plants. And it seemed the kind of thing that I would not have ever given a 10-year-old because it was so many tiny pieces and, but they were like flying off the shelves as kids rush to these things because like each one is different and you don't really know what you're going to get until you open it. So there's always, I'm always surprised by some of the stuff that the kids are always very focused on.
Yeah, those blind bag things, like that wasn't part of my culture growing up, but my kids are obsessed with it.
Yeah, very much the same. It's really interesting to see, how that has changed, especially the there's kind of two parts of it, right? There's the randomness of it all, and then there are the people who break down how you can kind of feel the packaging to know which one you're going to get, and they've like expert moded this. It was really fascinating to see a parent like looking on a website and going, "Oh, okay, well, if you feel the ridges on the bottom of this thing, that's the one that you want." Kind of cheating the system for these blind bags has become like its own mini game, which is
Oh
fascinating.
yeah, my kids watch those videos. I'm just like, what is going on?
Well, you don't want to get a wrong one. You got to get the right one.
No, I so how do we know we're getting the best deal? That's always that question, right? You see all these sales and there's that concern that they've, and I've even seen some of those videos, right, of big box retailers where it looks like it's 30% off, but it's the same price it was last week.
It's a real problem with every retailer, and it's kind of been that way for a really long time. The advantage that we as consumers have now is that there are several tools at our disposal for verifying those prices ahead of time. My personal favorite is one. Both of them have very silly names, but if you are trying to verify prices on Amazon, there is a service called Camel, Camel, Camel,
You've
just like the
mentioned it
animal.
before.
Yeah, I've mentioned it before. It is something that I use every day. You take your Amazon link, you paste it in there, and it will show you the price history so you can see for a fact that it is the lowest price on something before you buy it. There is a similar version of this tool for Walmart called Aisle Gopher,
Oh.
which has a very similar function. You take your Walmart link, you paste it in there, and it will show you the price history of that product so that you know that the price on the page is what you're actually getting as far as a discount goes.
Next week, you'll be telling us all about the best tech for teens, correct?
That is exactly right.
And then we'll do women and men. Is that kind of how it goes?
Yep, we'll do big kids next, and then as we get much closer to the holidays, I will try and round it out with stuff that you can actually get delivered right before for people like me who struggle with time and want to get something last minute.
Before we wrap up, I did want to ask you about one news item for last week, and that involves the U.S. Justice Department and a group of states asking a judge to force Google to sell its popular Chrome browser.
That's right. So, the Justice Department has been very heavily investigating the way that Google operates, and some of the sticking points that have come up have been some of the deals that Google has made around the Android platform, but also around Chrome. There are many web browsers that exist today. Some owned by Microsoft, some by owned by Mozilla, and some that aren't owned by kind of big corporations that are quite good. But it's tough to tell people that those browsers exist when Chrome is installed by default on your machine and it's already pretty good. So, kind of why would you bother with something else? But behind the scenes, it turns out that Google has made quite a few, financial deals with Samsung and HP and some of these others where Chrome is presented front and center. And that raised some pretty serious monopoly concerns in front of the Justice Department. So the current investigation is leaning towards having Chrome spin out as its own company that can make its own deals, and it isn't backed by the kind of the weight of Google.
Yeah, the Justice Department is essentially saying you can sell Android, its smartphone operating system, or be barred from making it mandatory on phones that use Android to operate. Like, this feels like a big deal, like a really big deal.
This is truly big. I have been doing tech work in various ways for most of my adult life, and I am old enough to remember when Chrome was kind of the gutsy new system on the scene that people used instead of Microsoft's Internet Explorer. That I'm old enough to remember the running joke that the only reason to use Internet Explorer was to log in once to install Chrome. That has been kind of a mantra for quite some time. And so to see Chrome become the elephant in the room that nobody else can avoid, just in the last 20 years, it has been a pretty remarkable industry shift. And Google has done some things they probably should not have done in order to maintain that popularity.
How do you think incoming president-elect Donald Trump could influence this case? Because this is really the Biden Justice Department being aggressive about monopolies.
While it is true that I think the Biden administration is going to handle this very differently from the incoming administration, I think taking on big tech is seen as this kind of winning point for a lot of folks, and kind of breaking this company up that is Certainly publicly no huge fan of the next administration, I think is likely something that will come to play in whether these deals stay or are changed.
That was Russell Hawley, Managing Editor for Commerce at CNET. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks, as always, for listening to All Sides here on 89.7 NPR News.